over and over again. I see Lorien the days before the war, the jungles and oceans I've dreamed of 100 times. Myself as a kid, running wild through the tall grass, while those around me smile and laugh, unaware of the horrors to come. Then I see the war, the destruction, the killing and the blood. Sometimes, on nights like tonight, I have distinct visions of what I believe is the future. My eyes aren't closed for long before I'm whisked away, and even as it begins, I feel myself entering a landscape I know I've never seen before, but still find familiar. I run down a pathway lined with litter and debris. Broken glass, burned plastic, twisted, rusted steel. Acrid mist fills my nose and causes my eyes to water. Decaying buildings stand tall against the gray sky. A dark, stagnant river lurks to my right. There's commotion up ahead. The sounds of yelling and metallic clattering swell in the thick air. I come to an angry mob surrounding a tarmac where a large airship prepares for takeoff. I go through a barbed wire gate and enter the airstrip, fenced off from the crowd. The tarmac is marked with small rivulets, the color of magma. Mogadorian soldiers keep the crowd at bay, while swarms of scouts ready the ship, an onyx orb hovering in midair. The crowd roars against the fence as soldiers knock them back. They're smaller than the soldiers, but have the same ashy skin tone. A low rumble grows from somewhere beyond the ship. The crowd hushes, taking panicked steps backwards, while those on the tarmac file into orderly lines. Then something drops from the hazy sky. A dark vortex absorbs the surrounding clouds, leaving a thick black discharge in its wake. I cover my ears before the object crashes to the ground, shooting vibrations through the soil that nearly knock me off my feet. Everything falls silent as the dust clears, revealing a perfectly spherical ship, milky white, like a pearl. A round door slides open, and a monstrous creature steps out. The same creature that tried to behead me in the rock castle. A brawl breaks out along the fence, with everyone scrambling to get away from this monster. He's even more enormous than I remember, with muscular, chiseled features and short, cropped hair. Tattoos crawl up his arms, scars are branded into his ankles, the largest of which stands out on his neck, grotesque and purple. The soldier retrieves a golden cane from the ship, its head curved like a hammer, a black eye painted on its side. When the creature holds it in his hand, the eye comes alive, rolling left and then right, taking in its surroundings until it finds me. The Mogadorian scans the crowd, sensing me nearby. His eyes narrow. He takes a giant step towards me, lifting the golden cane. Its eye pulses. Just then an onlooker shouts at the Mogadorian, furiously rattling the fence. The Mogadorian turns towards the protester, thrusting the rod in his direction. The rod's eye glows red, and the man is instantly ripped to shreds, torn through the barbed wire fence. Pandemonium erupts as everyone fights to get away. The Mogadorian returns his attention to me, pointing the rod at my head. I'm hit with a sensation of falling. Weightlessness rises in my gut until I'm on the brink of vomiting. What I see around his neck is so disturbing, so haunting, that I'm jolted awake as though struck by a bolt of blue lightning. Early dawn breaks through the windows, bathing the small room in the hard morning light. The shapes of things return, I'm sweat-covered and out of breath, and yet I'm here. The ache and confusion in my heart telling me I'm still alive, no longer in a dreadful place where a man can be ripped through the small holes of a barbed-wired fence. We found an abandoned house bordering a conservation area a few miles from Lake George. The kind of house Henri would have loved. Isolated, small and quiet, offering security without any personality. It's one story, the exterior painted lime green, while the interior is various shades of beige with brown carpeting. We couldn't be luckier that the water hasn't been turned off. By the heavy dust in the air, I can only assume it's been a while since anyone lived here. I roll to my side and glance at the phone beside my head. Having seen what I just did, the only thing that could take it all away is Sarah. I remember the time in my room when she'd just returned from Colorado. The way we'd held one another. If I'm allowed to save a single moment with her, then I choose that one. I close my eyes and imagine what she's doing at this very moment. What she's wearing. Who she's talking to. The news reported that each of the 6 school districts surrounding Paradise absorbed a portion of the displaced students until a new building is built. I wonder which of them Sarah's attending, if she's still taking photographs. I reach for my cell phone, the one prepaid and registered under the name Julius Caesar. Henri's sense of humor. I turn it on for the first time in days. All I have to do is dial her number to hear her voice. It's that simple. I press the familiar numbers one by one until reaching the last. I close my eyes, take a deep breath, then turn the phone off and flip it shut. I know I can't punch the 10th number. Fear for Sarah's safety, for her life, and all of ours too, stops me. Out in the living room, Sam streams CNN with one of Henri's laptops on his thighs. Luckily, Henri's wireless internet card, under whatever pseudonym he chose at the time, still works. Sam furiously scribbles notes on a legal pad. It's been 3 days since the mess in Tennessee, and we only arrived in Florida last night. Having hopped aboard 3 different semis, one of which carried us 200 miles in the wrong direction, before jumping a train that brought us here. Without the use of our legacies, our speed, Six's invisibility, we would have never made it. It's our intent to lie low for a bit and let the news dissipate. We'll regroup, start training, and avoid any further mishaps like the one involving the helicopters at all costs. First order of business, find a new car. Second order of business, figure out what to do next. None of us really knows for sure. Again, I feel the enormity of Henri's absence. Where's Six? I ask, stumbling into the living room.
Out back swimming laps or something, Sam replies.
The one cool thing about the house is the pool in the backyard, which Six immediately filled by directing a heavy rainstorm overhead. I'd think you'd want to catch a glimpse of Six in her bathing suit. I nudge Sam. His face reddens.
Shut up, dude. I want to check the news, you know, be productive.
Anything?
Aside from now being considered an accomplice and having the reward for me increased to $500,000?
Sam asks. Oh, come on, you know you love it.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, he says, grinning. Anyway, no, nothing new. I don't see how Henri kept up with all this. There are literally thousands of stories every day.
Henri never slept.
Don't you want to go check out Six in her bathing suit?
Sam asks, turning back to the screen. I'm surprised by the lack of sarcasm in his voice. He knows how I feel about Sarah, and I know how he feels about six. What's that supposed to mean?
I see the way you look at her, Sam says. He clicks on a link about a plane crash in Kenya. One survivor.
And how do I look at her, Sam?
Never mind.
The survivor is an old woman, definitely not one of us. The Lorik fall in love for life, man. And I love Sarah, you know that. Sam looks over the screen of the laptop.
I know you do. It's just that, I don't know, you're the kind of guy she'd go for, not some math nerd obsessed with aliens in outer space. I just don't see how six could fall for someone like me.
You kick ass, Sam, and don't forget it. I walk out the rear sliding glass door leading to the pool. Beyond the pool lies an overgrown yard enclosed by a brick wall, offering privacy from anyone who might wander by. The nearest neighbor is a quarter mile away. The nearest town is a 10-minute drive. Six zips across the water, skimming the top like some water-borne insect. And beside her, going twice as fast, is a platypus-shaped mammal with long white hair and a beard. I have no idea what animal Bernie Kosar is copying. Six senses me and stops at the edge, pulling herself halfway out of the water and resting her arms on the deck. Bernie Kosar jumps out and returns to his beagle form, shaking himself dry and covering me with water. It's refreshing, and I can't help but think how nice it is to be down south again. You better not be killing my dog out here, I say. I catch myself staring at her perfect shoulders, her slender neck. Maybe Sam is right. Maybe I am looking at Six the same way he does. I want more than ever to run back inside, turn on my phone, and hear Sarah's voice.
More like he's killing me. The little guy swims like he's totally healed. Speaking of which, how's your head?
Still hurts, I say, running a hand over it. But nothing I can't handle. I'm ready to start training today, if that's why you're asking.
Good, she says. I'm getting antsy. It's been a long time since I've trained with somebody.
You're sure you want to train with me? You know you'll probably end up hurt, right? She laughs, and then spits a mouthful of water at me. Oh, it's on, I say, visualizing the surface of the pool and forcing a blast of air over it. Water rushes towards her face. She dives beneath the surface to keep from being splashed. And when she comes up, she rides the crest of a huge wave that nearly empties the pool, bringing her towards me. Before I can react, she moves away, but the wave keeps coming, knocking me over and sending me crashing into the back of the house. I hear her laughing. The water recedes to the pool, and I stand and try pushing her backwards into it. She deflects my telekinesis, and all at once, I'm upended and sailing through the air upside down where I flail helplessly.
What the hell are you guys doing out here? Sam asks.
He's standing at the sliding glass door.
Six was talking smack, so I decided to put her in her place. Can't you tell?
I remain upside down, hovering 4 feet over the pool center. I can feel Six's grip around my right ankle, and the sensation is the same as if she were literally holding me up with one hand.
Oh, totally. Got her right where you want her, Sam replies.
I was about to make my move, you know, biding my time. So, what do you think, Sam?
Six asks.
Should I let him have it?
A smile breaks across Sam's face.
Take it away.
Hey!
I say just before she lets go, and I fall head first into the water. When I resurface, Six and Sam are laughing hysterically.
That was only round one,
I say, climbing out. I peel off my shirt and slap it to the concrete. You caught me off guard.
just wait. What happened to being tough and rugged? Sam asks. Isn't that what you said when you buzzed your head?
Strategy, I say. I'm just giving Six a false sense of security. Then when she gets comfortable, I'm going to pull the rug out from under her.
Ha! Yeah, right, Sam says, then adds, God, I wish I had legacies.
Six stands between us in her solid black one-piece bathing suit. She's still laughing, and water runs down her arms and legs as she leans slightly forward and twists her hair to wring it out. The scar on her leg is still discolored, but it isn't nearly as purple as it was the week before. She whips her hair back over her head. Sam and I are both mesmerized.
So, training this afternoon, then? Six asks. Or do you still feel like I might get hurt?
I puff my cheeks and release the air slowly. Maybe I'll take it easy on you. I mean, that scar on your leg still looks kinda nasty. But, yeah, we're on.
Sam, is that a yes for you, too?
You guys want me to train? Seriously?
Of course. You're one of us now, Six says.
He nods, rubbing his hands together.
I'm in,
he says, grinning like a kid on Christmas morning. But if you just want me for target practice, I'm going home. We start at 2 o'clock. But by the look of the gloomy sky, I don't anticipate training for very long. Sam bounces on the balls of his feet, wearing gym shorts and an oversized tee. He's all knees and elbows. But if heart and determination could be counted, I think he'd be nearly the size of the Mogadorian I'd seen aboard the ship. To start, Six shows us what she's learned of combat techniques, which is far more than I know. Her body moves fluidly and with the precision of a machine when she throws a kick or punch, or when she does a backflip to evade an attack. She shows us how to counter-assault and the merits of skill and coordination, and drills the same maneuvers until they come instinctively. Sam eats it up, even when Six pounds him backwards and he flips head over heels or has the wind knocked out of him. She does the same to me, and even though I try laughing it off like I'm playing around, I work my hardest, and she still kicks the crap out of me. I can't fathom how she learned all this on her own. After my mouth is filled with grass and dirt for the second time, I realize just how much she can teach me. The rain begins a half hour later. A light drizzle at first, but soon the skies open, sending us indoors for cover. Sam paces through the house, throwing kicks and punches at phantom enemies. I sit in the chair, my fist around my blue pendant, and stare out the front window for a very long time, simply watching it all happen, while remembering that the last two storms I saw both raged because Six told them to. When I turn back, I see that she's sound asleep in the corner of the living room, curled around Bernie Kosar, holding him in her arms like a pillow. It's how she always sleeps, wrapping herself into a ball on her side, her features losing their sharp edges. The white bottoms of her feet are aimed right at me, and I use telekinesis to lightly tickle the bottom of her right foot. She twitches it, as though shooing a pesky fly. I tickle her again. She twitches her foot a little harder. I wait a few seconds and then, as softly as I can, I tickle the length of her foot from her heel up to her big toe. Six pulls her foot back and kicks her leg straight out, the telekinetic force of which sends me flying into the nearest wall, leaving a hole revealing the interior wires and studs. Sam charges into the room and jumps into the perfect fighting position.
What happened? Who's here?
He yells.
I stand rubbing my elbow, which took the brunt of the hit.
Jerk?
Six says, sitting up. Sam looks from me to her.
You guys are ridiculous,
he says, retreating back to the kitchen.
Your flirting just scared the hell out of me.
Scared the hell out of me, too, I say, ignoring the flirting comment. But he's already gone and doesn't hear it. Am I flirting? Would Sarah think that was flirting? Six yawns, raising her arms to the ceiling.
Still raining?
Totally. But look on the bright side. The weather saved you from any further bruises. She shakes her head.
The tough guy routine is pretty tired, Johnny. And don't forget what I can do with the weather.
Wouldn't dream of it, I say. I try to change the subject. I hate myself for flirting with another girl. Hey, I've been meaning to ask you. Who's the face in the clouds? Every time you whip up a storm, I see this crazy, ominous face. She scratches the bottom of her right foot.
I'm not sure, but ever since I've been able to mess with the weather, it's always the same face that appears. I assume it's Lorik.
Yeah, probably. And here I thought it might be a crazy ex-boyfriend you've yet to get over.
Because, obviously, I have a weakness for 90-year-old men. You know me so well, John.
I shrug. Both of us smile. That night, I cooked dinner on a rusty but serviceable grill left on the back patio. Or try to cook, I guess. Since I took home economics with Sarah in Paradise, I'm the only one who knows how to make anything remotely resembling a meal. Tonight, chicken breasts, potatoes, and a frozen pepperoni pizza. We're sitting on the living room carpet in a triangle. Under the blanket, Six has draped over her head and body. She wears a black tank top, and her pendant hangs in full view. The sight of it returns my mind to the vision I had. I long for a normal dinner around a table, and a normal night's sleep where I'm not tortured by my Lorik past. Was that what it was like on Lorien before we left?
Do you think about your parents a lot? I ask Six.
Back on Lorien, I mean.
Not that much anymore. I can't even tell you what they look like, really. I remember how it felt being near them, though. If that makes any sense. I think about that feeling quite a bit. I guess. What about you?
I pick at a burned slice of pizza. I resolve never to cook frozen pizza on the grill again. I see them a lot in my dreams, which is really great, but at the same time, it tears me up inside. Reminds me that they're dead. The blanket slides off the top of Six's head and rests on her shoulders.
What about you, Sam? Do you miss your parents right now?
Sam opens his mouth and closes it. I can tell he's considering telling Six that he thinks his dad was taken by aliens, abducted when he went out for milk and bread. Finally, he says,
I miss them both, my mom and dad. But I know that I'm better off here with you guys. Considering what I know about everything, I don't think I could be at home.
You know too much, I say. I feel guilty he's eating my terrible meal on the floor of an abandoned house instead of feasting on his mother's food at a dining room table.
Sam, I'm sorry you got caught up in this with us, Six says. But it's nice that you're here.
He blushes.
I don't know what it is, but I feel a weird connection to the whole situation. Can I ask you something? How far away is Mogador from Earth?
I think back to when Henri blew on the 7 glass orbs, how they came to life. Soon we were looking at a floating replica of our solar system. It's a lot closer than Lorien is.
Why?
Sam stands.
How long would it take to get there?
A few months, maybe,
Six says.
Depends on what type of ship you're flying, and what type of energy it uses.
Walking in circles, Sam says, I think the U.S. government has to have a ship built somewhere that can handle that distance. I'm sure it's a prototype and top secret and hidden under a mountain that's hidden under another mountain. But I was just thinking about what would happen if we couldn't find your ship and needed to take the fight to them. Go to Mogador. We have to have a plan B, right?
Sure. What's plan A again? I ask, biting my tongue. I can't fathom fighting the whole planet of Mogador on their own turf. Getting my chest, Six says. She pulls the blanket back over her head.
And then what?
Training.
And then what? I ask.
We go find the others, I guess. It just sounds like a bunch of running and not much of anything else. I think Henri or Katerina would have us doing something more productive somehow. Like studying how to kill certain enemies. Do you know what a piken is? Those are those huge beasts that destroy the school, Six says. What about a crawl? Those are the smaller animal things that attacked us in the gymnasium, she answers. Why? In the dream that I had in North Carolina when you and Sam heard me speaking Mogadorian, those two names were mentioned. But I'd never heard of them before. Henri and I simply called them the beasts. I pause. I had another dream earlier. Maybe you aren't having dreams, she says. Maybe you're having visions again.
I nod. It's hard to tell the difference at this point. I mean, these dreams felt the same as the visions I had of Lorien. But I wasn't on Lorien during these two, I say.
Henri once said that when I have visions, it's because they hold some sort of personal significance to me. And that's always been true. The past visions were always of things that had already happened. But I think what I witnessed in my dream this morning, I don't know. It's like I was seeing it as it was actually happening.
Wicked, Sam says. You're like a TV.
Six crumples her paper towel and tosses it up in the air above her head. Without thinking, I set it on fire, and it wilts into nothing before landing on the carpet. Then Six says, It's not impossible, John. Some of the Lorik have been known to do it. That's what Katerina said anyway.
But the thing is, I think I was on Mogador, which, by the way, is just as disgusting as I imagined it would be. The air was so thick it made my eyes water. Everything was desolate and gray. But how did I get there? And how could this one huge dude on Mogador seem to sense when I was there?
How huge? Sam asks.
Huge. Like, more than double the size of the soldiers I saw. 20 feet tall, maybe more. Far more intelligent and powerful. I can tell just by looking at him. He was definitely a leader of some sort. I've seen him twice now. The first time I was overhearing information relayed to him by some little peon. It was all about us and what had happened at the school. The second time I saw him, as he was preparing to board a ship. But before he was on it, one of the others ran up and handed him something. I didn't know what it was at first, but just before the ship's door closed, he turned towards me to make sure I could see exactly what it was.
What was it? Sam asks.
I shake my head, ball up my paper towel, and burn it on the palm of my hand. I look out the back door at the setting sun, a blaze of orange and hot pink, like the Florida sunsets Henri and I watched from our elevated porch. I wish he was still here, to help make sense of all this now.
John, what was it? What did he have?
Six asks. I lift my hand and grab my pendant.
This,
These. He had pendants, three of them. The Mogadorians must have taken them after each kill, and this massive leader guy, or whoever he is, he put them around his neck like Olympic medals. And then he stood there just long enough so I could see. Each one was glowing bright blue, and when I woke up, mine was too.
So, are you saying it's a premonition? Like you just saw your fate? Or could you have just had a weird dream because of how stressed out you are?
Sam asks. I shake my head. I think Six is right. And these are all visions, and I think they're all happening right now. But the thing that scares me the most is that when that guy got on that ship, there's a good chance he was headed this way. And if Six is right about how fast a ship can travel, it won't be very long until he's here.
Chapter 11. The things I remember about coming to Santa Teresa are mostly just snippets of a long journey I thought would never end. I remember an empty stomach and sore feet, and being impossibly tired most of the time. I remember Adelina begging for change, for food. Remember the seasickness and the vomiting it caused. I remember disgusted looks from passers-by. I remember every time we changed names. And I remember the chest. As cumbersome as it was, that Adelina refused to part ways with no matter how dire our situation became. On the day we finally knocked at the door, Sister Lucia answered. I remember it being on the ground, tucked snug between Adelina's feet. I know she stowed it away in the shadows of some obscure corner of the orphanage. My days of searching have turned up nothing, but I still keep looking. On Sunday, 1 week after Ella arrived, we sit together in the back pew during Mass. It's her first, and it holds her attention about as well as it holds mine. Not at all. Aside from class, she's pretty much been by my side since the morning I helped her make her bed. We walk to and from school together, eat breakfast and dinner together, say our nightly prayers together. I've grown very attached to her. And by the way she follows me around, I can tell she's grown attached to me as well. Father Marco has droned on for a good 45 minutes, and finally I close my eyes, thinking of the cave and debating whether I should bring Ella along with me today. There are several problems with it. First, there's zero light inside, and there's no way Ella will be able to see through the dark in the way that I can. Second, the snow has yet to melt, and I'm not sure she'd be able to make the trek through it. But most of all, I worry that bringing her would be putting her in harm's way. The Mogadorians could arrive at any moment, and Ella would be defenseless. But even with these obstacles and concerns, I'm eager to take her along anyway. I want to show her my paintings. On Tuesday, minutes before we were to depart for school, I had found Ella hunched over on her bed, still chewing on a breakfast biscuit. I looked over her shoulder to see her furiously shading a perfect drawing of our sleeping quarters. The details, the technical accuracy of each crack in the wall, her ability to capture the faintest of squares of sun rays that dropped through the windows in the morning, was astounding. It was as if I was looking at a black-and-white photograph. "Ella!" I had blurted. She had flipped the paper over, trapping it against her schoolbook with her tiny smudged hands. She knew it was me, but didn't turn around. "Where did you learn how to do that?" I'd whispered. "How did you learn to draw so well?" "My father," she whispered back, keeping the drawing turned over. "He was an artist. So was my mother." I sat down on her bed, and here I thought I was a pretty good painter. "My father was an incredible painter," she'd said plainly. Before I could ask her more questions, we had been interrupted and then ushered out of the room by Sister Carmela. That night, I'd found Ella's drawing under my pillow. It's the best present I've ever received. Sitting in Mass, I think that maybe she can help me with my cave paintings. Surely I can find a flashlight or lantern somewhere here to take with us. And then my thoughts are interrupted by a fit of giggles beside me. I open my eyes and look over. Ella's found a red and black furry caterpillar that's in the process of crawling up her arm. I bring my finger to my lips in a sign of silence. It stops her for a brief moment, but then the caterpillar climbs higher, and she begins giggling again. Her face turns red while trying not to laugh, but the fact that she is trying to stifle it only makes it that much harder. And then she can't help herself, and a string of laughs escape. Every head snaps around to see what's happening, and Father Marco stops his sermon in mid-sentence. I snatch the caterpillar from Ella's arm and sit upright, staring back at those staring at us. Ella stops laughing. Slowly, the heads turn back around, and Father Marco, clearly flustered at having lost his spot, resumes his sermon. I sit with my hand around the caterpillar. It tries wriggling free. After a minute, I open my fist, and the sudden movement causes the furry little thing to curl into a ball. Ella raises her eyebrows and cups her hands together, and I place the caterpillar in them. She sits there, smiling down at it. I scan the front row. I'm not at all surprised to see Sister Dora glaring sternly in my direction. She shakes her head before turning back to Father Marco. I lean over to Ella. "When prayer ends," I whisper into her ear, "we have to get out of here as fast as we can and keep away from Sister Dora." Before Mass, I'd fixed Ella's hair into a tight braid, and now, gazing up at me with her big brown eyes, it looks as though the heavy braid is weighing her head back.
"Am I in trouble?"
"We should be okay," I tell her. "But just in case, we'll rush out of here before Sister Dora can catch up to us. Got it?"
"Got it," she says.
But we don't get the chance. When there are just a few minutes left, Sister Dora stands and casually strolls to the back, and then stands waiting at the door a few steps away. When my eyes reopen, as the final prayer ends with the sign of the cross, Sister Dora places a hand on my left shoulder.
"Come with me, please," she says to Ella,
reaching across me to grab her by the wrist.
"What are you doing?" I say.
Sister Dora pulls Ella past me.
"It's none of your business, Marina."
"Marina," Ella pleads.
As she's being dragged away, Ella looks back at me with scared eyes. I panic and rush to the front of the church where Adelina is standing, talking with a lady from town.
"Sister Dora just grabbed Ella and pulled her away," I quickly say, interrupting her. "You have to make her stop, Adelina."
She looks incredulously at me.
"I will do no such thing. And it's Sister Adelina. If you'll excuse me, Marina, I was in the middle of a conversation," she says. I shake my head at her. Tears form in my eyes. Adelina doesn't remember what it feels like to ask for help and not receive it. I turn and run from the room and up the winding staircase to the church offices. To the left, at the end of the hall, the only door closed is the one leading to Sister Lucia's office. I race towards it, trying to decide what I should do. Should I knock? Should I kick straight through it? But I don't get the chance to do either. When I'm within reaching distance of the knob, I hear the crack of the paddle, followed instantly by a scream. I'm frozen in shock. Ella cries on the other side of the door, and a second later, the door is opened by Sister Dora.
"What are you doing here?"
she snaps at me.
"I came to see Sister Lucia," I lie.
"She's not here, and you're due in the kitchen. Go on," she says,
shooing me the way I came. I'm headed there myself. Is she okay? Marina, it's none of your concern, she says, and then grabs me by the bicep, spins me around, and gives me a shove. Go, she orders. I move away from the office, hating the fear that runs through me every time confrontation stares me in the face. It's always been that way. With the sisters, with Gabriela Garcia, with Bonita on the dock. I get the same feeling, the same nervousness that quickly segues to dread, that always causes me to walk away. Walk faster, Sister Dora barks, following me down the staircase and towards the kitchen where El Festín duties await. I have to use the restroom, I say before we reach the kitchen, which is a lie. I want to make sure Ella's okay. Fine, but you better make it fast. I'm timing you. I will. I duck around the corner and wait 30 seconds to make sure she's gone. Then I rush back the way we came, up the staircase, down the hall. The office door is slightly ajar, and I walk through it. The interior is dark, somber. A layer of dust covers the shelves that line the walls, upon which sit ancient books. The only light enters through a dirty, stained glass window. Ella? I say, for some reason thinking she might be hiding. No answer. I walk away and poke my head in the rooms situated off the main hallway, all of which are empty. I call her name as I go. At the hall's opposite end is the sister's sleeping quarters. There's no sign of her in there either. I go back down the stairs. The crowd has made its way to the cafeteria. I walk to the nave, looking around for Ella. She's not in there. Nor is she in either of the two sleeping rooms, nor the computer room, nor any of the storage rooms. By the time I've looked in most places I can think to check, a half hour has passed, and I know I'll be in trouble if I go to the cafeteria. Instead, I hurry out of my Sunday clothes, pull my coat off its hook, swipe the blanket from my bed, and dash outside. I trudge through the snow away from town, unable to push the sound of the paddles crack and Ella's scream from my mind. I'm also unable to forgive Adelina's scorn towards me. My whole body tense. I focus my energy on some of the large rocks I pass, using telekinesis to lift and hurl them against the mountainside. It's a great way to blow off steam. The snow surface has hardened, creating a thin layer of ice that crunches underfoot, but it doesn't keep the rocks from skidding downhill. I'm so mad I could let them go, careening towards town, but I stop them in their tracks. My gripe isn't with the town, but rather its namesake, and those who live within it. I pass the camel's back, half a kilometer to go. The sun is warm on my face, situated high in the sky and slanted towards the east, which means I have at least 5 hours before I'm due back. I haven't had this much free time in a great while, and with a bright sun and crisp, fresh wind pulling me from my dismal mood, I hardly care that I'll be in trouble when I get back. I turn to see how effective my blanket cape is at hiding my prints in the hardened snow, and I'm afraid to see that it hasn't worked at all today. Nevertheless, I push forward until I spot the rounded shrub sticking up over the snow. Then I race towards it, at first not noticing the very thing my eyes should be attuned to, that the snow at the base of the cave is tossed up and pushed around. But as soon as I reach the cave's entrance, I know immediately that something is horribly off. Approaching from the south, a single set of boot prints, double the size of my own, dot the mountainside, a perfect straight line cut into the snow leading from town to the cave. They seem to tromp around its opening, as though circling it. I'm flustered, certain there's something else here I'm missing. And then it dawns on me. The prints, they lead into the cave. but they don't lead back out. Whoever they belong to is still inside.
Chapter 12.
They're here, I think. After all these years, the Mogadorians are finally here. I turn so fast I slip and fall into the snow. I quickly crawl backwards away from the cave's mouth, my shoes tangled in the blanket. Tears well up in my eyes. My heart races. I manage to right myself and sprint as hard and as fast as my legs will carry me. I don't even look behind me to see if I'm being followed, sweeping across the same snowy terrain I'd just hiked through, moving so fast I hardly take note of where my feet are falling. The trees below me begin to blur, as do the clouds above. I can feel the blanket hovering behind my shoulders, flapping in the wind like a superhero's cape. I trip once and slide across the ground, but immediately scramble to my feet and sprint onward, jumping straight over the camel's back, again crashing when I land. And then I finally dash past the birch trees and make it back to the convent. The hike there took nearly 25 minutes. The sprint back took less than 5. Like the ability to breathe underwater, the legacy of super speed presents itself when I need it to. I untie the blanket from around my neck, burst through the double doors, and hear the lunchtime clatter coming from the dining room. I hurry up the winding staircase and down the narrow hall, knowing it's Adelina's turn to take Sunday off. I enter the open room where the sisters sleep. Adelina sits regally in one of the 2 high-backed chairs, Bible in her lap. She closes it when she sees me coming. "Why aren't you at lunch?" she asks. "I think they're here," I say, out of breath, my hands violently shaking. I bend over and rest them on my knees.
"Who?
You know who?" I yell.
Then, between my closed teeth,
"Mogadorians."
Her eyes narrow in disbelief. "Where?"
"I went to the cave."
"What cave?" she interrupts.
"Who cares what cave? There was a set of boot prints outside of it. Huge boot prints."
"Slow down, Marina. Boot prints outside of a cave?"
"Yes,"
I say. She smirks, and I instantly realize coming to her was a mistake. I should have known she wouldn't believe me, and I can't help feeling foolish and vulnerable standing in front of her. I straighten. I don't know what to do with my hands. "I want to know where my chest is," I say, not exactly in a confident voice, but not in a timid one either.
"What chest?" "You know exactly what chest."
"What makes you think I held on to that old thing?" she asks calmly.
"Because you would be turning against your own people if you didn't," I say.
She reopens her Bible and pretends to read. I think of leaving, but then my mind returns to the boot prints in the snow.
"Where is it?"
I ask. She continues to ignore me. So I reach out with my mind and feel the contours of a book, its thin, dusty pages, its rough-hewn cover. I snap the book shut. Adelina jumps.
"Tell me where it is."
"How dare you?
Who do you think you are?" "I am a member of the Guard, and the fate of the entire race of Lorians depends on my survival, Adelina. How could you turn your back on them? How could you turn your back on the humans, too? John Smith, who I believe is a member of the Guard, is on the run in the United States, and when he was pulled over recently, he was able to move the officer without touching him, just like I can do, like I just did with your book. Don't you see what's happening, Adelina? If we don't start helping, not only will Lorien be lost forever, but so will Earth, and this stupid orphanage, and stupid town."
"How dare you call this place stupid?" Adelina steps towards me with clenched fists.
This is the only place that let us in, Marina. It's the only reason we're still alive. What did the Lorik do for us?
They pushed us onto a ship for a year, and then they pushed us out onto a cruel planet without any kind of plan or any instructions other than to stay hidden and train. Train for what?
To defeat the Mogadorians! To take back Lorien! I shake my head. The others are probably out there right now, battling, figuring out how to come together and how to get us home, while we're stuck in this prison doing nothing!
I'm living my life with purpose, helping the human race with my prayers and service. And you should be too.
Your sole purpose on Earth was to help me.
You're alive, aren't you?
Only in the literal sense of the word, Adelina.
She sits back in her chair and opens the Bible on her lap. Lorien is dead and buried, Marina. What does it matter?
Lorien isn't dead. It's hibernating. You said so yourself. And the point is, we're not dead.
She swallows hard. A death sentence has been handed down to us all, she says, and her voice slightly cracks. Then, in a much softer tone, she says, our lives were doomed from the beginning. We should do good while we're here, so we may have a good afterlife.
How can you say that?
Because that's the reality. We're the last of a dying race, and soon we'll be gone too. And may God help us when that time comes.
I shake my head at her. I have no interest in talking about God. Where is my chest? In this room?
I walk around the room, casting my gaze along the ceiling's edges, and then I crouch and peer beneath a few of the beds.
Even if you had it, you can't open it without me, she says.
You know that.
She's right. If I'm to believe what she'd told me years before, when I could still trust the things she said, then I can't open it without her.
The futility of it hits me all at once. The boot prints in the snow, John Smith on the run, the sheer and utter claustrophobia of Santa Teresa, and Adelina, my Saipan, meant to help and assist in developing my legacies, who has given up on our mission. She doesn't even know what legacies of mine have developed. I have the ability to see in the dark, breathe underwater, to run at super speeds, to move things with my mind, and the means to bring plants back from the brink of death. Anxiety sweeps over me, and at the worst possible moment, Sister Dora enters the room. She props her fists on her hips.
Why aren't you in the kitchen?
I look at her and mirror the same scowl she's giving me.
Oh, shut up,
I say, and march out of the room before she responds. I run down the hall, down the stairs, grab my coat again, and push through the double doors. I look wildly around as I move within the shadows lining the side of the road. Though I still feel as though I'm being watched, outside nothing seems amiss. I race down the hill without letting my guard down, and when I reach the cafe, I enter because it's the only place open. About half of its 20 tables are occupied, which I'm thankful for. I have the urge to be surrounded by people. I'm about to sit when I notice Hector alone in the corner, drinking wine.
Why aren't you at El Festín?
He glances up. He's clean-shaven, and his eyes appear clear and sharp. He seems well-rested. He's even well-dressed. I haven't seen him this way in quite a while. I wonder how long it will last.
I thought you didn't drink on Sunday, I say, and immediately wish I hadn't.
Hector and Ella are my only friends at the moment, and one has already disappeared today. I don't want to upset Hector as well.
I thought so too, he says,
not taking offense.
If you ever know a man who tries to drown his sorrows, kindly inform him his sorrows know how to swim. Here, sit down.
Sit down,
he says, kicking out the chair across from him. I plop down in it.
How are you?
I hate this place, Hector. I hate it with everything inside of me.
Bad day?
Every day is a bad day here.
Eh, this place isn't so terrible.
How are you always so cheerful?
Alcohol, he says with a sideways grin.
He pours himself what looks to be his first glass from the bottle.
I wouldn't recommend it to others, but it seems to work for me.
Oh, Hector, I say. I wish you wouldn't drink so much.
He chuckles, takes a sip.
You know what I wish?
What?
That you didn't look so sad all the time, Marina of the Sea.
I didn't know that I did.
He shrugs.
It's something I've noticed, but Hector is a very perceptive man.
I look to my left and to my right, pausing to focus on each person here. Then I take the napkin off the table and put it on my lap. I put it back on the table. Then I put it back on my lap.
Tell me, what is troubling you? Hector says, then takes a larger sip.
Absolutely everything.
Everything? Even me?
I shake my head.
Okay, not everything.
His eyebrows rise and then furrow.
Now, tell me.
I have a deep urge to tell him my secret, the reason I'm here and where it is I really come from. I want to tell him about Adelina and what her role was supposed to be, and what it has instead become. I want him to know about the others, out there on the run or fighting, maybe sitting idly like me, collecting dust. If there's one person I'm certain would be my ally, who would help me in any way he could, then surely it's Hector. He is, after all, a defender, who's meant to hold fast, and who was born into power and bravery by such simple means as the name he was given.
You ever feel like you don't belong here, Hector?
Sure, some days.
Why do you stay, then?
You could go anywhere.
He shrugs.
Several reasons.
He pours more wine into his glass.
For one, there's no one else to take care of my mother. Plus, this place is my home, and I'm not convinced there's much better out there. My experiences have taught me that things rarely improve with a simple change of scenery.
Maybe so, but I still can't wait to leave. I only have a little over 4 months left at the orphanage, you know. And you can't tell anyone this, but I think that I'm going to leave sooner than that.
I don't think that's a good idea, Marina. You're very young to be on your own. Where will you go?
America, I say without hesitation.
America?
There's somebody there I need to find.
If you're so determined, then why haven't you already left?
Fear, I say. Mostly fear.
Ah, you're not the first, he says, taking a moment to empty his entire glass.
His eyes have lost their sharpness.
The key to change is letting go of fear.
I know. The door to the cafe opens, and a tall man wearing a long coat and carrying an old book enters. He moves past us and takes a table in the far corner. He has dark hair and bushy brows. A thick mustache covers his upper lip. I've never seen him before, but when he lifts his head and meets my gaze, there's something I immediately don't like about him, and I quickly look away. From the corner of my eye, I can see he's still staring at me. I try ignoring it. I resume talking to Hector, or rather, I babble, hardly making sense, watching him refill his glass with red wine, and I hear next to nothing of what he says in reply. 5 minutes later, the man's still staring.